This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. The Boston Archdiocese has settled its case with more than 500 people who said they were abused by Roman Catholic priests. The Archdiocese will pay out $85 million to the victims. And a bomb exploded at a busy bus stop outside of an army base in Tel Aviv today. At least 4 people are dead, 30 wounded. Those stories coming up later today. Details on them both on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow, join us as we broadcast Talk of the Nation live from member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano is among our guests. I hope you'll join us. Today, we've been exploring what it's like to go out in the world as part 3 in our obesity series. Tune in next week for part 4 as we explore food addiction. Right now, though, the Army has decided that about 20,000 members of the National Guard and reserves will have to stay in Iraq for a year. That's longer than originally expected. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that the reservists provide critical support for active duty troops. He says with the nation at war, using the reserves this way is how the system was set up. But he acknowledged that the military has to be careful not to do any long-term harm to the reserve and National Guard system. Well, if you're a reservist or a member of the National Guards or have a member in your family, give us a phone call. 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And tell us what you think of this decision. Joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon, a military specialist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's with us from Brookings Studios. And thanks very much for being with us again today. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you.
The Pentagon order, first of all, this was issued on Friday, not publicly announced, really, and reported today in the Washington Post.
Well, yes, and there is the old game of leaking bad news on days when people aren't going to notice, and there may be a little bit of that going on here. But I think that we're, as General Myers said, in a fairly uncomfortable position. We built the military in a certain way to require the use of reservists in the event of any large-scale operation. But that was thinking more about war. Here we are in a long-standing stabilization mission, and we're going to be asking so much of these reservists and, of course, asking more than we told them we would when they left, and that may be the greatest insult of all. It really underscores the problem we have today, which is the Army just is not big enough and doesn't have enough active-duty forces for the mission at hand.
Well, we'll focus on that in just a moment, but going back to the structure of the American military, 10 or 15 years ago, the Guards and Reserves were afraid that the active duty military was going to cut out all of their interesting and important roles and relegate them to, stateside duty. And their advocates were the ones who advocated restructuring the military to give the Guards and Reserves critical roles in the American military.
Yes. Well, they had critical roles. They still do. But if you go back to that debate, a big part of what that debate was about was trying to add more people to the reserve component who can support active duty combat troops and have fewer dedicated combat forces in the National Guard. Mm-hmm. In other words, it would have been good to carry out the reforms as proposed because we would now have more people to do these sort of support activities, civil affairs, police, and so forth, that we don't have enough people to do inside the Army Reserve in particular. And therefore, we have to keep asking the same people to do the job over and over. So on this point, I actually think, with respect, the reserve component was wrong. It tried to protect too much of its combat force structure, most of which is not being used in this mission, and did not create enough additional capacity to do the kinds of support that we need most of in the current mission.
The decision will undoubtedly create concern, and particularly, you would think, on the troops who are in Iraq now.
Yes, and I'm struck. I've got a good friend there now, Jim Barr. I'm sure many of us have good friends and family in Iraq. I'm struck by the good spirits of my friend and his willingness to keep at it. But on the other hand, you can't expect people to keep doing this sort of thing indefinitely. And you can't expect them to stay in the reserves once they come home, especially if there's any prospect of their having to do the same thing all over again. And that's the unfortunate position we find ourselves in. We're extending deployments beyond the promised dates of return, which is bad enough. And then we're going to have to call up people a third and fourth and fifth time unless we figure out some way to restructure the Army.
Now, let's go over some of the numbers in the basics. There are some, 350,000 troops in the Army National Guard and 205,000 in the Army Reserve. Give us some perspective on those numbers. What do they do?
Well, the National Guard essentially has two main kinds of soldier. One is this type in the combat units that I just mentioned a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there, frankly, are more of those than we're likely to need for almost any conceivable contingency. But in addition, you have people in the National Guard doing support, doing, let's say, logistics or equipment repair or civil affairs and so forth. The Army Reserve, however, is the piece of the Army Reserve component that is really dedicated to support activities exclusively. It does not have any combat force structure to speak of. So the National Guard really has as many brigades and divisions as the active Army. They're just not as highly trained. They don't have as much time, obviously, to train. There's a big debate over how good they are and how much time it would take to get them battle-ready or ready for a place like Iraq. That's one piece of the National Guard. The other piece looks more like the Army Reserve.
Now, as I understand it, this new policy only applies to those troops now in Iraq. It won't affect people who are members of the Guard and Reserves but are now at home. Is that right?
Well, that's right. But on the other hand, the Pentagon has also been pretty slow with information about how long it thinks it's going to have to stay in Iraq and who's going to do the missions in the future. For example, the Pentagon has been quite clear about the rotation schedule for getting troops currently in Iraq home and replacing them, but it has not told us anything about the third rotation. Who is going to go into Iraq next fall around presidential election time or in the winter of 2004-2005? Who is available to do that rotation? The reason they haven't told us is because the short answer is nobody's available. Everybody, without almost any exceptions, will have already been to Iraq, Afghanistan, or Korea in the previous 24 months, and you won't have any fresh troops. Likewise, with the reserve component, we don't want to talk about it now because, frankly, we're hoping that the problem goes away before we have to impose this severely on yet another group of reservists. But, frankly, I don't see any way out of this except to keep putting unreasonable demands on the very same kind of units that we're now initially asking to stay longer in Iraq and Kuwait.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Joel, who's on the line with us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yes, I'm a National Guard member, and I spent 4 months in Afghanistan last year. And I just received word that I'd be going to Iraq again this year. So this means basically that I've put 2 years of my life on hold. I do realize I signed up to serve my country and everything, but I've also heard a lot about how the system as it is not being taxed. We don't need to up what Rumsfeld calls the end strength. And that's just a bunch of crap. I'm sorry. It is. It's taxed. I go over there and I see guys doing three or four other people's jobs. It's just amazing. But yet the powers that be don't want to acknowledge it. Everybody wants to say it's okay and in hopes it goes away. But I was there on the ground. I saw it. And, you know, it's just not true.
And what do you do for a living when you're not serving, Joel?
I'm a student. I'm in school. I'm trying to get my degree and finish school.
And so when you were called up originally to go to Afghanistan, overall, how long was that commitment, including the time overseas?
It was a year-long commitment, 4 months overseas.
And now Iraq is going to be another year?
Probably. It'll be a year plus, it looks like, a year on the ground over there, plus whatever time it takes to do the mobilization process and all that. So.
And what's your specialty, I'm sorry?
I'm an intelligence analyst.
Mm-hmm. And those are in Michael O'Hanlon's short supply.
Indeed. And if I could ask Joel a question, Joel, what would be a reasonable amount of time, do you think? How long would it be reasonable to give you between deployments? In other words, if today's pace is too heavy, what's acceptable?
I would say at least a year or two. I would say at least a couple of years for people to get back in track. I was actually supposed to go with my unit. My original unit deployed within 90 days of coming back from Afghanistan. And I had some personal problems, and I was able to dodge the bullet, so to speak, and not go. But that doesn't matter now. They're taking everybody they can get to fill slots to go to Iraq. It's just amazing. But I would say at least a couple of years.
Right. And of course, the problem today is that we have about 140,000 out of our total reserve component activated. And a lot of those people were already activated before after 9/11 for domestic protection or for the Afghanistan mission, as Joel's mentioned. So you're in a situation where some units are getting called up basically, you know, every year or two, and with no sign of that changing any time, just as Joel's case. His case is not that unusual. It's a little bit on the severe end of things, but it's not that unusual because we are calling up one out of every four reservists at any given moment.
Yeah, a lot of people got called up after 9/11 and did duty National Guardsmen in airports and that sort of thing, and then found themselves getting called up again this time. Joel, thanks very much, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, Michael, as we look ahead to this, obviously this overstretch situation, at the same time that you have Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld speaking in Baghdad and other places, saying there is no need for additional American troops and hoping maybe for a division of foreign troops or, you know what I mean, perhaps European or Indian or Turkish or something like that to go in and help. Is he saying that because there's no military requirement for troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq, or is he saying that because he has no troops to send?
Well, I'm afraid there's a little bit of both going into the explanation, as I can tell, because I guess one thing I could do is to point out that between this year and next year, Mr. Rumsfeld is going to have to send almost every single division of the U.S. Army to Iraq, and the only ones that don't go are going to be the ones stuck in Korea or Afghanistan. And so by the end of that period of time, let's say towards the end of 2004, everybody will have done one tour in Iraq, every combat unit in the U.S. active duty Army. And so even if we get this international division, the question then becomes, what do you do in the fall of 2004? Who do you send then? How do you avoid the problem of having to do a rapid repeat deployment? So Mr. Rumsfeld, I think, has to acknowledge that as much as his vision for future warfare may involve fewer ground combat troops, at this moment we temporarily need a larger army. And I think, frankly, he's just not being realistic in his assessment of the situation. I commend him greatly for a marvelous war plan that did make use of fewer ground forces than many people thought would be necessary, and you got to give him credit for that. But it doesn't mean that he has to therefore be sort of obstinately consistent across the board and say that we also have to limit the size of the army for peacekeeping. Maybe the peacekeeping mission still takes a lot of people, even if the wartime mission does not.
Mm-hmm. Let's go now to John, who's on the line with us in Sacramento.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Navy reservist, so I have a bit of a different perspective, perhaps, than the Army perspective that's been discussed. But one point that I'd like to make is I don't think perhaps Secretary Rumsfeld or the American people appreciate the sacrifice that many reservists have to make. We're in a position where we actually are, with as little as 2 weeks' notice, are told to drop everything in our lives, pick up and leave our families. That's actually something that doesn't happen to an active duty troop.
Obviously, it doesn't. Active duty troops are obviously active duty and generally get a little bit more notice, though, you know, there are certainly exceptions.
That's correct. And as an active duty sailor, if you're assigned to a ship, you're on a regular rotation. You understand when you'll be going away. However, reservists, in addition to working full-time jobs, donate more or less much of their free time and weekends and several weeks a year at least to serve their country on a voluntary basis.
Are we asking too much, John?
Well, I think that perhaps it just needs to be recognized, perhaps by the strategic thinkers, that reservists are indeed in a unique position, and this is an extremely valuable and possibly volatile resource.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Go ahead, Michael O'Hanlon, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree, it's a very fragile resource. And thankfully, at least, John may or may not fully agree with this point, but the Navy and the Air Force, having now helped win the war to overthrow Saddam, can at least stand back to a somewhat more normal pace of activity. It's still a very demanding pace, and we're asking a lot of them. But the Army has not in any way reduced its deployments or its commitments as a result of the end of the war. In fact, they increased somewhat with the arrival of the 4th Infantry Division after Saddam fell. And so you're in a situation where the Air Force and Navy are beginning to recover. I'm just saying beginning to recover. They've still done a lot of work, and their people are tired and still working hard. But the Army is simply getting its back broken. And we have to focus in on that particular aspect of the problem and do it quickly.
John, thanks very much, and thank you for your service. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And Michael O'Hanlon, it's always good to have you on the program.
My pleasure.
Michael O'Hanlon is a military specialist, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joined us from the offices of the Brookings Institution down Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, D.C. We'll be broadcasting from Phoenix, Arizona, and the studios of member station KJZZ tomorrow. I hope you'll join us then. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.